Roger Williams University is hosting a crisis management seminar on May 3rd at their Providence campus. Crises, whether a natural disaster, cyber attack, or financial instability, can have severe repercussions if not handled properly. This is where crisis management plays a pivotal role. Join Roger Williams MBA students and expert speakers to learn how to prepare for the unexpected. The program is totally free and open to the public. You can register online at rwu.edu/events/crisis-management-symposium.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
For up-to-the-moment Rhode Island news, follow at Bill Bartholomew on X.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits, and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.
Hi, I'm Lisa Conlon Lewis. I'm the executive director here at Parents Support Network of Rhode Island, and we are the Prevent Child Abuse Rhode Island chapter of Prevent Child Abuse America.
Thanks, Lisa.
Good morning. My name is Lamel Moore. I am the director for Prevent Child Abuse Rhode Island and also the chairman for the Rhode Island Fatherhood Initiative.
All right. So there's a lot that we could get into for sure in this broad space. And quite frankly, just this week, we've seen some really disturbing reports from DCYF. Anytime I get a communication from DCYF about without even reading the subject line, you know that there's going to be something sad in there. And that's just one small component of a broader arena that when it comes to child abuse prevention is important to discuss. I guess really just kind of to tee off this conversation to sort of get into the right direction. Lisa, your overall assessment right now of the work that you do and the greatest needs.
I would say there is such a need for more prevention education so that we can meet, you know, again, even when we hear about the four deaths last week, they were very young infant children. So that ability to have parent education as early as possible, even down to the school level, like having parent education at the high school level, at a preventative level, is really important. There's such a need to really look and make sure that we're getting the right wages for the providers too, so that we can have the capacity and the workers to be able to have those eyes on our families, right? The ability to be there, provide more support, more education, even if it's up to the level of helping them to co-parent. Mm-hmm. That becomes really important because then we know our kids are going to be safe, right? And so to me, the concern around the opioid epidemic is huge too. So many of the families that we're working with that are child welfare involved, we specialize here at Parent Support Network as the peers who have overcome opioid addiction and mental health challenges. So the ability to have that recovery support for our parents is really important too. And if you look at the number of deaths or near deaths, there's usually been substance use involved.
Same question, Lamel.
I believe everything what Lisa just said, it really does get down to the prevention. And one of the things that we're trying to work on and do our best is creating those avenues and those opportunities where we can provide prevention to those communities across the state. And not only that, but also provide educational opportunities to the necessary pockets that are throughout the state. So, for example, reaching out to the school departments and giving them reinforcement on child abuse and letting them know that there's an active opportunity to call us for additional training and prevention and opportunities. And also to another segment, which is absolutely needed. And because of my background in youth development with the Boys and Girls Clubs and the YMCA for 14 plus years, is those summer camp and enrichment opportunities that do occur during the summertime. Because as we know, when schools are in session, those children go to the schools, so those teachers who are mandated reporters can view and see things that we cannot or other people cannot while those students are in school for the 6, 7.5 hours that they're there. And when they're home in the summertime, those opportunities are less viewed.
Mm. Well, that makes complete sense. And it's something that we learned during COVID on an opposite level, from the opposite standpoint, in terms of just how the role that schools and extracurricular activities play in providing that foundation. In fact, that's something that Governor McKee has really tried to level up a little bit with some of the Learn 365 initiatives that he's brought to the table. It's such a heavy lift, this type of work. And I commend both of you for being involved in it, because like I said, it's just, there are different aspects to this conversation, but at the end of the day, it's one that you wish you didn't even have to have. But the reality of the world that we live in is what it is. Lisa, what are some of the circumstances that you've discovered through your work that have led to some of the worst outcomes in terms of just prevention and understanding those?
I think first and foremost is we have to look at the true disparities that exist, right? So one of the big things that we promote, especially in our workforce here at Parent Support Network, is everybody works towards becoming a certified community health worker. And why that's really important is so many of our families, right from the beginning, have endured, structural racism. There's a lot of disparities as it relates to all different social determinants of health. First, being even access to treatment and healthcare, being able to find equal opportunities for employment, intergenerational trauma. So I can tell you, I've been in this field a long time. We are now serving the children as parents that were the children we were serving. So it's very intergenerational. And if the healing and the support is not there, so if you take structural racism, intergenerational trauma, and then now let's lay that COVID took place, we have seen such an increase on people's well-being, their mental health, the unhoused situation right now, housing. Like, if I don't have a place to put my head down at night, that creates huge stress. We have, over 140 families I know right now, just even touched or involved with our organization at this level, who are unhoused. That's just within our organization, having that connection.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talk about social determinants of health, and this extends to that. And it's something, again, you mentioned it. We learned it during COVID. We learned the importance of a network of brick and mortar facilities and of understanding that those social determinants of health are, they have a ripple effect that if you don't get ahead of it, you will not be able to control it most of the time. And, from your experience, kind of the same thing. What are some of the big picture areas that folks should know about when framing a discussion here?
I think there's really nothing else to say, really. I think she hit it on the nail on that, if anything, if I can add one chip shot into that, maybe it would be possibly, there is, the educational, the educational piece and the financial literacy piece of things. Mm-hmm. I would add in those two chip shots. Educational piece, only because obviously without education, you're really not going to go anywhere. You have less opportunities. There's many studies that have shown that. And I think over the last 10, 15 years, we've also seen that financial literacy also plays a tremendous part in that as well. And not for nothing, it's not cheap to live. And so if you're worried about paying $2,400 for a studio apartment or a one bedroom apartment, and you're a single mom or a single dad, that's tremendously hard.
Completely agree. The financial literacy piece is so critical. It's something that shockingly is not taught in most schools. And
yes,
And that's foundational as well. I mean, you talk about reality of even putting it into the conversation of health, mental health, that's there. So we've kind of established these big picture clusters of issues that all work together to create this environment that we're kind of tapping into today. And so the next obvious question would be taking a look at solutions and the work that each of you do through your organization on the ground. Lisa, what are some of the most important solutions that you've identified that need to be deployed that you either are already working on or you need more support to be able to make happen?
More parent education, right? So the ability to have as much, and it's out there, you know, there isn't a lot of parent education classes out there. So, you know, we do nurturing parenting here at Parent Support Network, but most families almost have to get court ordered in the parent education that it isn't ready. And back to the prevention piece, there should be multiple agencies offering parent education at a very preventative promotional, like for, it shouldn't be a DCYF referral or a family court referral. It needs to not be stigmatized. It needs to be right there in front of folks. Also, you know, as community health workers, whatever that social determinant of health, we are available and supportive and can even transport people to get them to link, connect, get them to whatever, whether it's education, employment, parenting, you know, domestic violence classes, whatever that is going to be, we have the opportunity to have a workforce that can bring people towards those goals of those steps to try to prevent out-of-home placement. We also have children with very high-end behavioral health needs, and that sort of pushes parents and stresses them at their parental level. So the ability to make sure that we're getting access to good behavioral health treatment is really important. And again, people since COVID have sort of lost that face-to-face, and many of them end up in a telehealth appointment. That does not work for children. Kids need hands-on, and actually they need coaches, they need mentors, they need caring adults. So the more that we can link and connect to that is super important, and having a workforce that being, having people drop by, we do wellness visits in the home. It's like versus a social worker, they may feel like is dropping over to catch them. We're more coming in to say, how can we catch you doing good things and help you do better things with your children? And Lamel can probably speak a lot more to the importance of dads having really equal opportunities. We work really hard to hire dads at PSN, in addition to the moms and grandmas. And we're all about family here at PSN. So we actually hire a workforce very reflective of overcoming some of the hard challenges that others are going through.
That's the exact point. I wanted to see if you could tap into, Lamel. It's bringing fathers into the picture, because you do, it's a generic thought, but it does feel oftentimes that this is a mother-child type of conversation when, of course, it ought not be.
No, exactly. It's very disappointing at times as well when those dads or male father figures are not given the opportunity to even express or show their concerns. So what we do here as a parallel track is on Wednesday nights from 5:30 p.m. until about 7:15, depending on the conversation, is we offer something called our peer-to-peer or our father-to-father program here. And actually, we're in the middle of National Child Abuse Prevention Month right now for April, and we've been bringing in guest speakers. So today's guest speaker is the one and only male doula in the state of Rhode Island that we found. My fatherhood coordinator, Sean Gray, was able to find him and contact him, and they were able to develop a small little program for the 90 minutes that he's going to be here tonight. So that's going to be wonderful. It's going to be great. I'm looking forward to it. But with that being said, having those dads there in the program and having them vent and learn from each other the ups and downs and trials and tribulations is very, very important. Especially too, a great example is we had a dad who was here last Wednesday, but you know, his son was just diagnosed with ODD and ADHD, and another dad through the translator said, "Oh, my son has that as Quentin as well. And here are some things that I do. And, you know, I have a structured timesheet," and, you know, and so they're able to learn from each other and not be totally completely frustrated with that. And one of the things that we're trying to do with the RIFI, with the Rhode Island Fatherhood Initiative, is you know, put dads on a little bit of a on a better standpoint, comparable level to what they have been before when they're going through the reunification process or seeking just a little bit more time with their child. But to have those programs that coincide with each other here at Parent Support Network Rhode Island and with RIFI and the partnerships that we're trying to establish is going to make, I believe, is going to make a tremendous difference. But at the same time, we know that it is going to take time. It's not going to be an overnight oats situation, if I may say that.
My last question is, you know, without opening up too many cans of worms here for each of you, starting with Lisa, governmental support. Is the state of Rhode Island doing enough to prevent child abuse?
I think there's a strong committed, both at the, you know, the government and the government, you know, contracts with a large network of providers. I think we're all very collectively working together towards solutions with government. I do think that I'm going to just bring it back to workforce capacity. You know, I think government would be in agreement that there's a need for more workers to be directly eyes on and working hand in hand with the families. I know all the providers are also huge shortfalls as far as worker rates, which then brings people back not to have the continuity of care and the capacity they need to deliver. And then even sometimes archaic reimbursement processes. I know we struggle as an organization, and I'll put the plug out there that we're always seeking donations and unrestricted funding because everything we do is cost reimbursement. So we have to outlay all the money to help others before we get reimbursed by government. So it holds back that ability to really be proactive and bring the level of capacities that are really needed. And I know we're not the only agency struggling with that right now. That's a huge government discussion about, again, sometimes if all the different government partners aren't working together around the issues of the, it doesn't just belong to DCYF. These issues cut across all government, and we have to be working together, or those that are most vulnerable are not going to get the level of support they need.
Well said. Same question, Lamel.
There's really nothing else to add.
Yeah.
You know, from that standpoint, obviously Lisa looks at it from a more macro 10,000 foot level, and maybe I'm at a 7,000. I would say from the standpoint of the training going out and being on the ground with organizations and through RIFI. So if I may answer those in two separate ways. So with Prevent Child Abuse Rhode Island, it is just a matter of, for me, from my standpoint, is making sure we have the staff to go out there to continue to do the work and do the training and bring the awareness of it all. And I was, this month, once again, is National Child Abuse Prevention Month. So we were invited for state proclamation. House Minority Leader Mike Chippendale and Rep. Sherry Roberts were very welcoming, and thank you for providing that proclamation and putting that eyesight onto us for the state. So that was greatly appreciated. And for the RIFI standpoint, for helping dads, that's what we actually do need more resources. When I tell you that I recently just learned that there is a drop in the lawyers in the state who practice family law, because they just don't want to do it. They say, you know, it's too emotional, nothing gets done, and they really don't have the opportunity to practice law. And I understand that. You know, you go to law school, you want to practice law. You want to get in there and do your law and order kind of thing. And I completely understand that. But I think too, in terms of the RIFI, we do need more funds. We do need more opportunities for that. And I think that, with the upcoming study group that we do have led by Rep. David Bennett, Rep. Sherry Roberts, and House Minority Chippendale, and hopefully we will be able to get in Rep. John Breen from Woonsocket this week, that awareness and that funding piece will eventually come into it as well. But once again, we know that we are down the road for that. That's just going to take time. And our partners in Connecticut are rooting us on, and hopefully we'll get to that point as well.
Lisa, Lamel, thank you so much for the work you do, first of all, and thanks for the time this morning. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.